Horseback scan initiated. I'm picking up a podcast arriving. Wait, designation. Forge the Narrative.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host. We all about Lost Souls podcast. I'm joined by Red Powell.
Hello.
And Tanya Gates.
Hey, everybody.
We are on the eve, the precipice of the World Championships of Warhammer and the Grand Narrative in Atlanta. I cannot wait. I really cannot wait. It is, I'm feet from it, measurable in feet from where that will all be going down. And I'm incredibly excited. So with that said, I will be down there next weekend. Ray will be down there next weekend. A lot of us will be down there next weekend. We will probably not be able to record a show next week. But we're at least going to talk about it now and talk about the results after the fact as countries, delegations from around the world descend upon Atlanta to crown the World Championship of Warhammer across a bunch of different games. Kill Team, Warhammer Underworlds, the Age of Sigmar, Warhammer 40,000. Going to be trying to bring you as much of that coverage as possible. All happening at the same time as the Grand Narrative, where hundreds and hundreds of players are going to be playing in a story that is going to contribute to the lore and fabric of Warhammer 40K from now until going forward. Can't wait. Cannot wait. Curious to see if there's going to be any list innovations there. Are people going to be bringing what is the tried and true, what they think is going to win, what got them there? Are they going to go outside the box and play things they think are going to take them over the top of what everyone else has brought? I'm not sure what they
would you do.
So a mixture of things. I think I would bring the faction that I'm most comfortable with the rules wise, you know, because it is a bit of an endurance, like you're playing. So I shouldn't say endurance. You're playing two games of 40K a day. That's not
piece
bad.
Of cake.
That's not bad, right? But you're also playing against people that are the best in the world. The people that have won the events in their country and then been able to come to this event, this venue, and play. These are people that are not used to losing games. So I want to control, to answer your question directly, I would want to control some of the variables. I would like to have some rules, maybe some detachments, some base rules that I'm very comfortable with. And then I want to make sure that I've got some things that I think are going to push me through the final games. Like I want to use my skill, my familiarity, and then I want to have some tech that's going to help me win my last couple of games, doing the best for my country.
Yeah, to that point, you know, I totally agree. I think that there's clearly people that are going to be leaning into efficiencies and the robustness that some of the lists bring to bear. And with that, you know, the fortunate part of how they dropped the FAQs and the erratas, almost a month ago now. So people have had at least 30 days to adjust, because everybody who had a Chaos Cultist list is no longer running that kind of list, right? Because the surge movement has been shifted due to the errata and how they approach it. And so now people are not leaning into that in the same way. There's still ways to play it, but doesn't share the same efficiencies that it had before the errata. And so there's clearly some shifts. And you just hope that the people who shifted to that list in the first place weren't, you know, so stuck, like that was the only thing they had available to them, and that in the last 30 days, they've had the ability to adjust off of that to find out a different way forward.
To answer your question directly, I'd be taking angels and charging all the time as much as possible. That's what I would do.
I mean, you know, for me, even with the shift to surge movements, because it wasn't a huge deal, you know, there's Rhino Rushing Berserkers, been doing it for 7 years now. Not sure why I would stop.
But the folks we're talking about that are going and competing, and especially the ones that are swinging for the fences, that want to bring home not only just individual wins, but also contribute to their country's success over the course of the weekend, you know, they're going to be thinking about, I think, that what's going to give them that edge over what they believe people are going to be bringing. And I think it's a safe bet to think people will bring the tried and true. We have a very diverse meta right now. I understand that people may have a different perception of that because what they play at their local stores or what their friends play against them, they may feel like the meta is set, you know, but out there on the national and international scale, where these events that have, you know, several hundred people, what we're seeing is that there's a very diverse, like, top set of factions. Like, we're seeing like 11, 12 factions and fit into that top three bracket. You're like, how could that happen? Like, well, there are, let's say in a 100-player event, there may be 14 guard players, 10 marine players, 10 Eldari players, 10 Votan players. You know, that's a very chunk, like half the factions are getting played in the top five factions or of the placings in the overall course of the event. So it's a pretty diverse meta. And so I think people are going to kind of bank on those efficiencies, and then there'll be some that try to play around it. And I'm curious if those are the ones that try to play around it are going to be successful. Now, a lot goes into winning games of 40K, as we know. Die roll, strategy, pairings, you know. I've been recently testing, like I played, it finally happened. I lost a game.
I only laugh because you had to come into the group chat and post it. And we're all like, oh no.
Look, I've been on a bit of a tear recently. Like if someone is not losing games of 40K, they're not playing enough 40K. You know, because you play this game, especially playing, you're going to lose some games. It's going to happen or whatever. But I've been on a bit of a streak against one of my buddies, and I got destroyed this past weekend, and it's like that perfect storm. It was, you know, not the best mission. Perception wise for my list, and then not the best deployment and terrain layout for my list. And sure enough, it was not the best. And a good game all the way through. But you know, we're talking about like how do you win overall events? Is you kind of hope to avoid those list mismatches and mission mismatches, you know, around the way. And I know that generalship and, of course, you know, dice and decisions and choices and mission flips matter in those things, you know, so it's not, you can't rule out that just because you have the bad matchup and the bad terrain, then you're going to lose. You're automatically, you know, that's not the way a lot of players think. It's not the way players at this level think. So I do think it's going to come down to some list choices and minimizing the luck. That's what all the great players try to do. And this is going to be the event that I think helps showcase that. And I'm excited to see it. Hopefully that makes a little bit of sense. But those are the things I'm going to be looking for. My eagle eyes, as I'm commenting on some games and looking around and finding lists that I think are exciting, that may bring a little bit of difference. Even if it's the same faction, I don't think the same components are going to be there. I think some percent is going to be different for the players that are trying to swing for the fence.
So we know that, for instance, the Australian meta is very, very different from what we see in the United States and Canada. Do you expect to see different list archetypes showing up from different parts of the planet?
That's a great question, because I can tell you that short answer, yes, I do. But I know that these players, especially if you're going through the effort of traveling internationally, you do a lot of research and studying on what you expect to see. Just as for instance, Death Guard have been popular in Europe for a long, long time. Like, they take up a chunk of Europe. And so what I say by that is that I think there are some more Death Guard faction specialists in Europe right now than anywhere else. And I think Death Guard have seen a bit of a rise in power, like at least a notch or two on the power scale. And so are we going to see that? And then are these other players going to try to anticipate that and try to battle into it or against it? Or is it going to be a situation where everyone just brings what they know they're good at, and does that win? And I know we're kind of circling around the question, but, you know, going back to the original thing is that, you know, this is a bit of an endurance game, and this is a bit of the fact that maybe you have less unforced errors because you play something that you are ultimately very, very, very familiar with, and you don't experiment. And maybe the not experimentation and the playing, just the consistency of what you know that you can deliver, is actually going to win more games than not. All things considered, taking out some of those variables of the worst pairing and the worst terrain and and all that. I know I'm doing a lot of talking in my hands, because anyone seeing this on the video knows that I'm simulating the deployment zones and and the terrain layouts. That's what's happening. If you're listening to this on the podcast aggregators, it's awfully animated over here, because I'm so excited about what is happening or what will be happening next weekend. And kudos, like a big what's up to my opponent. He was playing guard, and he shot off a lot of my power pieces. It was Mephisto on died to Overwatch. I was not happy about that.
Wow. What did he get Overwatched by?
A bunch of lucky sixes. That's what he got Overwatched with.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Fair enough. It wasn't a hellhound.
Yeah, you hit 75% of the time. Great.
It's better than its ballistic skill, really.
Yeah. No, it's a good game and always a good match, but it was fun. But I've been trying to test into those situations as well, like what is an uphill battle, and then of course all players you're going to encounter those things. You're going to encounter those uphill battles, and how do you handle it? Hopefully you don't fold, you know, like I did, or at least try to minimize it. But there's a lot of variables in the game, and that's the best players are going to try to minimize those. And in these showcases like this, where the best players come out to play, you do get to see some great things. Sometimes they can kind of literally manifest things, what seemingly get out of bleak situations. And when you, you know, watch and observe how they do that, you can kind of maybe work it into your games. And looking forward to capturing some of that stuff on camera. We will be doing live streaming from the event, streaming the championships for both Age of Sigmar and Warhammer 40,000. And it's going to be spectacular.
I always learn something new whenever I watch those games, either through the commentary or just sort of watching how the players move, because movement is really hard to master. There's really not a playbook for it. There's not a manual for it. And some of the moves that these players make are so precise, and they make it look so easy. And I'm always just blown away by the skill. So I like to watch these games.
So comfortable. Yeah, like with their movements. Like yeah. They're just like, oh, I'm just going to do this, and this. You know?
Yeah, and then there's me. Like, I'm trying to move my stuff with precision. It does not look effortless at all. No.
We did a segment similar to that, like a few episodes back, where we kind of talked about evaluating a unit's effectiveness. And some of those players will describe the unit, and they're always in their best light. And really what that means is, like, to them anyway, is they are good at finding the place where that unit can shine and orchestrating it, maneuvering it to where that unit does its best thing. You know, what that really means, they have the right number of command points at the time, they do the right sequence of events, they puts them in the driver's seat, you know, and like they line it up. It's not luck, right? But they speak in a way that, like, this unit always does X, Y, and Z. But it's really because they found out a way to make it happen more often than not. But we'll see how it all plays out.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, talking about, you know, making the units shine. I went to the new player and veteran doubles event that they had. And it was definitely a learning experience for both of us. But my new player was playing Tau and just brought like a bunch of power and no chaff whatsoever. So I think for him, a really big takeaway was like using the chaff to make sure that he's not getting charged, right? Because on paper, you look at Guardsmen and you're like, wow, wow, what do these guys even do, right? But then him actually getting to see on the table how to like position them in such a way that, you know, you can keep your stuff safe. But he did not like keeping his stuff safe. He did not like hiding behind terrain.
You can't shoot if you're behind terrain. You got to get out there and zap.
I guess, but if there's nothing to zap at, what are you going to do? You know, like, we really worked hard on positioning ourselves so that if anything did come out to play, you know, he was in a position where he could then shoot. But that was not fun for him. He did not like that, unfortunately. So, yeah.
What do you think it was, like, as far as like not liking that, do you think it was just the idea of restraint of maybe, like, could we we play a 5-turn game, right? And so if you're not shooting for one turn, you've cut out, 20% of your fun? Like,
yeah, I think so.
Do you think you felt that way?
Yeah, I think that he just didn't really like the idea of competitive play, right? I think for him, he would rather get the game going, and he doesn't want to play cat and mouse, and even if his stuff dies, he'd rather, like, jump up and do something with it. And, you know, that's fine. Right? It's fine if that's how you want to play. Unfortunately, where we live, not very many people are going to be as understanding of that kind of play style. But, you know, I don't think he really cared either way. So, like, whether he won or lost. So, yeah. Oh,
I love that, living that dream of Warhammer. I got because we do, like, I think it's living that dream of, wouldn't it be cool if, like, wouldn't it be cool if I jumped over this building and shot everything and just stood there and just withstood the hail of fire from the opponents, which is possible. It's very possible, especially with something with an invulnerable save or whatever. It's very possible. Mm-hmm. And then if it didn't work out that way, you at least tried to live the dream.
Yeah. Yeah. You, I think he wanted to live the dream.
And you know, and I bet he feels like he knows he could just play another game after this and maybe it will work.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, we played into, so he told me before the event started that the only thing, like, if he could walk away by getting Farsight into close combat and, like, because he had, like, a little retinue of the flamey crisis suits. If he could just flame something with those and get Farsight into combat, he would have been happy. And so I made that happen in the first game. And, I guess everything after that was just fine. But unfortunately for us, our second game was against Death Guard. And as Tau and Guard, playing against Death Guard is really hard to manage sometimes. And I had one shooting unit. Like, everything else of mine was just, like, chaff. So that was, I think, a really hard lesson, too, because he wanted to get up and get close. And unfortunately, with Death Guard and a really bad ballistic skill.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I think there were some tough lessons. But I think he had fun.
Tough lessons. I'm finding it tough to think that was a lesson. The more I'm hearing about this, I think he is trying to, like, be cool with like that idea of the, whatever the nth possibility is.
Yeah.
And then if it doesn't work out, he'll just play another game.
Yeah.
Now, when I say that in a tournament setting, you know where you are. There's at least some type of outcome at the end, and with a teammate involved, it's a different calculus.
Yeah.
So maybe he wasn't thinking about that, but.
Yeah, and I just also know that, like, the people that we were playing against would more than likely exploit that to the fullest degree.
Yeah.
In which case, like, everybody else's games are going to be done, and you're going to be sitting there waiting for your next game. You know, like, I'm trying to get us to get to game to turn five.
So. with models.
Exactly. Yes, with models still on the board. Yeah.
Yeah, that restraint, I could see. Yeah, there's, of course, I'm talking about a little bit tongue in cheek, because, you know, enjoyment in the game where you aren't necessarily focused on points. You know, you're just wanting to use your toys and then hoping that the whatever you were thinking about while you were building them and painting them, you know, works out.
Yeah. So if him and I ever play 1v1 against each other, I have a number of friends who have the same mentality, and we just play kill points. Whoever can kill the most points at the end of the game wins, because then they don't have to worry about, like, keeping track of points. They don't have to worry about changing conditions or anything like that. They can just go out and kill stuff and get some points, and then they have a great time.
That is.
And for me, it's kind of nice to play that way too. You know, you can kind of turn the brain off a little bit.
That's
more
real
than
third
you
edition.
Normally would. Yeah.
And we loved it back then. It was. But how was the event overall?
I think the event was really well. It was really well run. Nice long break for lunch, which I love. Everybody seemed to be having a really good time. Some great prizes. I walked away with, like, a handmade wooden dice box. So I feel like
that sounds awesome.
Yeah, it was super awesome. Like, there's some really great prizes, and they were first time tournament organizers, and they slayed it, really. I brought a table of terrain. I think a couple other event goers brought some terrain as well, and it was great. Yeah, no complaints whatsoever.
You say first time event organizers. Do you think that they were, like, trying to run the event like they wanted?
Yeah.
They would want to play in. Is that how it all shook out?
Yeah. Yeah. They actually reached out to me pretty early on, because they are not super competitive themselves, right? So they wanted to make an event that was a little bit more welcoming to people of all levels of play. And so they were asking me a bunch of questions. Like, hey, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? They basically like slapped some veteran wrists as well, saying, hey, you're a veteran, that's way too good. Like, you need to take less good stuff.
I like that sculpting of the event they want, to, like, what they're trying to do, what they're trying to achieve. That's cool. That's, I think every tournament organizer has that right, because they are literally assuming all the risk of whatever it is they're doing. And if they're trying to create an environment, then that's great. They did. I mean, really, I think it's cool they did that.
Yeah. I mean, we have a ton of competitive stuff around. Like, the only events really in the area are very, very competitive. So it's nice for us to have a little bit of something different every once in a while, you know? But I think that they did a really great job. And yeah, everybody was having fun. I was seeing smiles at every table, and they just did an awesome job.
What pairing took it down? I say took it down like it was a super competitive event. Like, what pairing ended up being the most successful or had the most fun, or whatever the criteria for winning is? What? How did it work out?
It was the Death Guard players that we played against. So it was Death Guard and Ultramarines. And the Ultramarines was DACA Marines, just all shooting. So they won both of their games. We won one and we lost another one. So we lost to the team that won. Won. In air quotes.
I often suspected the Ultramarines have felt the touch of chaos. So with that... On that note, let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We got more Warhammer stuff to talk about. We'll see you in a minute, everybody.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games, Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Everybody, we are back. Welcome. Please check out our sponsors. Check us out on Patreon. Like, share, subscribe. Leave some comments. People have been leaving some comments on Spotify, which I did not know was possible until very recently. So it's, I guess it's a new thing if you're listening on Spotify. Thanks for the 5-star reviews and the comments. Really appreciate that. It's the engagement that we get to see that helps us, you know, basically helps the algorithms convince other folks to come here and hang out with us. And we appreciate that. In the break and before the show, we're talking about your list that I know you're taking it for the narrative, but some of the stuff that you're taking for this Imperial Agents list, I think has a little bit of like meat to it that is being kind of overlooked now.
Yeah, it's something that I don't think should be discounted, and I can understand how it would be. When you look at it, it's this army where its special rule is really to attach it to other armies. It's not so much, in a lot of cases, I don't think that, and there's some great stuff, because I've been playing around with it, going back and forth with different aspects. I've tried just about every Ordo associated with the Imperial Agents, except for Malleus, really. Even though every list that I've played, I have included, I've included the Grey Knights, because the Paladin Squad is just a nice little tanky thing to have. Like, it's awesome. It's only a 5-man thing, so it's not like it's a massive deal that's really like throwing out. You know, it's not so overbalanced, because you can only have 5. You can't make it 10. You can't make it this like unstoppable shield kind of deal, but it's strong enough to hold in. But there's also some really good narrative aspects to it, in that, so like my current list, I've got Sisters. The Sisters come with sticky objectives, so there's the nice part of having that. They also, you can spread
sticky
them out.
Sticky objectives
immolate.
Means if you control them and you move off of them, they stay under your control, and your opponent has to come get them from you.
That's right. That's right. And so with that, it's this aspect of being able to, you've got that, but they also come with immolators. And immolators, when the points increase came out a month ago, immolators went up for Sisters, but they didn't adjust for Imperial Agents, because you don't have the efficiencies associated with Faith Dice. And so that wasn't, I mean, I can see why the immolators, but they're also still great vehicles. And the ability
You still have ability to scout them in the...
So you don't have the ability to scout them. However, they are still... I mean, they're very effective Razorbacks as far as I see it.
The only reason I bring them up is also want to mention that I'm a fan of the same unit. I shouldn't say a fan, like it's... I can appreciate the same unit having different point levels in different codexes, because there are the different efficiencies like you were describing. Like, I think that's a nuance that this current system of 40K affords, and we, heck, I'd be in favor of even more of it.
Sure, sure. Yeah, exactly. And so it's it definitely still has some, like, I've seen the M-Laters as like this and the Sisters as the utility that the Imperial agents can take advantage of. Now, my favorite kind of way that I've gone about playing them has been using the Imperial Fleet detachment, which so my newest thing that I finished building that I'm really happy with the way it turned out, I had a lot of hobby fun with, I guess you could say, were 22 Death Watch models that I built. And so you can kit out the Death Watch based off of their, it's only the Death Watch veterans. GW, the GW community page, Warhammer community, has come out and said they're going to drop something in December. But the only thing that came out for Death Watch really were the Watchmaster, Captain Artemis, who's actually a long holdover from some old school Inquisitor stuff, which is really awesome. And then the Death Watch veterans. The veterans can be loaded out. They can either go ahead.
I can't let you get past that. Artemis was a 105 millimeter or something?
He was.
Yeah, 108 millimeter. And then
people don't realize the throwback that he was.
Yeah, didn't get his model until that box set with the Death Watch versus the Eldar, like Eldred's new model came out in that same thing. And he had the model, which is the exact same pose of what that Inquisitor scale is what it was. The game was Inquisitor. I forget what the millimeter of it was. I think
it's larger. Yeah, it's larger.
108 millimeter or whatever, but the same pose. So that's what you're talking about with the throwback.
It's a classic throwback. I mean, it's just cool to see, sometimes we see stuff where we agree or disagree, the respect given to the old art and the old styles that they've gone to, and then they bring this in. And Artemis is great. If you attach him to a squad of Death Watch, he essentially gives lethal hits to all their attacks. Death Watch are just across the board. They reroll ones to hit against everything. And then if it's not Imperium or Chaos, so if it has any other keyword outside of those two, they reroll all to hit. And then you can take that squad, and it's a multi-tool in how you build it. You can commit. And so I played around with three different variants. I had a balanced variant, a melee variant, and a ranged variant, where it just, you bring all the guns if you're going melee. You can bring, they've got this cool Hellfire bolter, which has got a flamer and a heavy bolter built in. So it's either or on those profiles. They've got the frag cannon, which is like a blast strength 7 auto cannon. I mean, it's a blast auto cannon, effectively. Just a lot of cool. And then their natural build for the Death Watch veterans is their bolt rifles, which are just essentially bolters, and then power swords, so the variation that then goes into that. Well, my melee variant is what I kind of built, because as I played the Imperial Agents and I played through it, I realized I needed something that could kind of, the Grey Knights were good, but when I'm playing the fleet list, one of the enhancements I take is clandestine operations, which allows me to give three infantry units infiltrate. It just makes them infiltrators, which is good. I mean, there's some great flexibility to that. There's a built-in thing with rogue trader entourages, which allows you to spread out essentially strategic reserves to units and put units into strategic reserves. So there's a lot of utility in deployment and whatnot. But giving these melee focused Death Watch squads infiltration to be able to put them up front, and they're meaty. We're talking 10 guys plus Watchmaster. The Watchmaster gives the ability to fall back or advance and charge, just built in. And then his other thing is that he allows you to use a stratagem at minus one CP, which is effective for that squad. And so you attach him in, and he's no joke either. I mean, he's got 6 attacks going into it. He does D3 damage, strength 6, it's a bolt spear. And so you put him into it. So you add him on. You've got the sergeant, who's got a xenophase blade, which is devastating wounds, 5 attacks, 4 attacks, sorry. And then you've got 4 guys with storm shields. So 4 up invulns to go around. Not bad, right? Like a little bit of a soak there, depending on how you want to try and kill them.
Haven't heard points yet, but doesn't seem too bad.
So a squad, a squad of 10 guys is 200 points. And so just throwing it down there. And then you've got 4 guys with Thunderhammers. And the Thunderhammers are 3 attacks apiece, hitting on 4s, strength 10, AP minus 2, 3 damage, devastating wounds. And so those are probably some of the best Thunderhammers I've seen in the game. And you can look at it, well, like, why aren't my Thunderhammers like that? Well, These guys, I mean, let's see, I've got one here.
They are big Thunderhammers.
They are quite big Thunderhammers. Yeah, I mean, they bring it. But, you know, again, I was saying, like,
they were heavy Thunderhammers or something like that.
They were. Yes, correct. They used to be, like, heavy Thunderhammers, and now they are just Death Watch Thunderhammers. And so, like, you know, but again, I was talking about the fun part I was having with the hobby of them. You know, so they've all got, and again, people playing Space Marine 2, if you don't know, you can buy certain chapter pieces. You know, you can buy, like, looks and aesthetics in Space Marine 2. Well, certain chapter aesthetics that you buy at the end of those, you can be rewarded by also having to purchase, I mean, with in-game currency, Death Watch detailing. And so you can essentially make your own Death Watch character in Space Marine 2. And so it's really cool. The let's see, focus, but you can kind of see that.
Can't nobody see that.
They get it. If they know what I'm talking about, the there's the Death Watch shoulder pad, but the between the Death Watch shoulder pad and then the next part being that they so the veterans kit comes with stylized shoulder pads for older, or I say older, for the chapters across the Space Marines. And so, like, you know, this, the, there you go, Paul, focused enough, you can get the idea of the bat wings, right? I mean, like,
this is great for the podcast aggregators. Yep, Red is showing some Death Watch shoulder pads.
Yep, in blurry resolution. But it was really fun as I got to that point where I was like, hey, you know what? I'm just going to take a second and pay special attention to these different shoulder pads for all these different chapters, because none of them are the same. And so they've all got their left, it's like traditional armor set for Death Watch, is the left arm is the Death Watch arm, like it's the silver shoulder pad, silver arm. And then the right arm, so their armor is naturally black, but then the right shoulder pad is whatever chapter they originally hail from. Because the way the Death Watch are pulled together is they're hired, recruited from across all the different chapters. They serve a term or so, maybe longer, in the Death Watch. If they're fortunate enough and live long enough, they can go back to their chapter at some other point after the fact. And so just some cool representation across the board. And I had a lot of fun kind of playing into that with... You know, I have a Space Wolf model, and I gave it an axe. I you know, dug through my bits and found a power axe that I had, and then, you know, the gave the Imperial Fist model I had the hammer and shield kind of deal. So just fun stuff like that. It's a lot of fun. So all that to say, though, the Death Watch models and the melee units really gave and started to bring together what I thought I really needed for the Imperial Agents, which was this frontline unit that could hold on its own and really dish out some damage. I could see, I haven't gotten around to making the ranged versions yet, but I could see where if you leaned into the Death Watch detachment, because unfortunately, almost all of its stratagems, it comes with an armor contempt stratagem, right? Like your baseline Space Marine. But then it has three other stratagems that are entirely about ranged. It's all the rounds. It's the historical Death Watch rounds, Kraken rounds, Hellfire rounds, you know, it's those. And so, unfortunately, these melee guys have no business using those stratagems because only one of them. Now, what is cool, though, is the Imperial Fleet Detachment has a stratagem, two stratagems particularly. One is Disruptor Fields, that after you finish shooting at this unit, like you target a unit in shooting, once you finish being shot at, you can then essentially move that unit a normal move 6 inches. And so, like, you can get that, you know, that squad could get either a lot closer that if you want it to, or it can be moved away and you can manage the fight better, which is a really useful utility tool. And then the other one is this, it's a 2CP strat. It's really strong. I'll pull it up in the app real quick, but essentially you use it and it allows you to, it gives you, for all your attacks, you can either use it in the shooting or the fighting phase, and it gives you sustained hits, lance, and one more thing, but it's totally worth it. Absolutely. it hits hard.
Is that something you get a discount on with the Watchmaster?
Yeah, yeah. And so it's called Violent Acquisition. Your shooting phase or your fight phase, one agents of the Imperium unit. That's what I like about the fleet deal, is that it's not so specific. Like, it's not your Ordo Hereticus or Malleus or whatever. So many of the things in the fleet detachment are just anything. And so in a lot of cases, I'm just, okay. So it gives you sustained hits, lance, and ignores cover. So you're not worried about cover necessarily in a lot of cases. But the sustained hits and lance on the charge can be such a big deal and making such a huge difference. I mean, with that, you're talking 30 plus attacks that could take out vehicles and things like that, because you've got lance and you're increasing your strength like that, and you're re-rolling to hit in so many cases. I'm pulling up the data sheet.
You're bringing these shenanigans to the Grand Narrative, right?
Well, I mean, I sit here and say that that's like these efficiencies that I'm looking at in the Grand Narrative. But like at the same time, I mean, I'm playing Navy Breachers and Arbetes and...
No, there's definitely a theme. I'm giving you a hard time. There's a theme to your list and like a theme to your whole thing that you're doing there. I don't know if you want to tell us what you're doing there, but...
Oh, I don't mind. I mean, like, again, like there is a theme to it. This is supposed to be a strike fleet, and it's this Inquisitor that I've got, that I've had in previous narratives, who is bringing to bear everything he can to sink it into this effort. And so he has this detachment of sisters who he helped in a previous campaign. He has the Death Watch, which he's pulled together to fight for him. He's got this contingent of Arbetes and the Imperial Navy based off the fleet that he's all. And so it's awesome to have this. And my retinue is a band of, you know, an inquisitorial war band of eclectic characters that have all come together. And the thing, once it all gets in there, I mean, and to the fun part of this again is, you know, if anybody asked you what the most efficient knight, if you were going to bring an allied knight, it is not the Knight Errant, I'll tell you that, the one with the Melta cannon. But that is what I've gone about, and I can tell you I had a lot of fun. I think you can see some of it. But my knight has, here again, for those listening via podcast, I'm showing off my knight.
We're only seeing the tops, very top of the very shield. Top.
Yeah, it's custom plating and whatnot, and so this is not plating that you'd normally find. I went and got some special made pieces for it that have some inquisitorial motifs on it. And so I was really excited to get that together too. And to say, like, in your retinue, you've got a knight pilot, you know, a free blade pilot that's part of your inquisitorial retinue is going to be a lot of fun as well.
For people who are just listening, the knight matches Red's cosplay armor as well.
Oh, yeah.
Which is such a cool touch.
The whole army, I'm really hoping, like, when it's on the table, I've got a display board that I'm setting up. Like, my cosplay should play right into the entire army, because everybody is a mix and match of, I mean, it kind of, again, playing into the inquisitorial deal of crimson, burgundy, reds. Like, there's all sorts of reds represented through different parts of the army. And then black, gunmetal, gold, like it all goes around. And so I'm really excited to get it out and to have it all together.
Well, so as we're getting closer to the narrative, like, you've been interacting with the Discord, and the warlords, you believe, are starting to interact with the Discord
as well.
People psyched up for the narrative. A little bit, what's gone down? Just give us a brief synopsis of what's been going down.
So, like I mentioned before, and you know, we've talked about the narrative and how it plays into it. The Discord is a huge deal, and I know, like, you know, it's not everybody's deal, and not everybody has time to follow it. I mean, there's so many people that are committed into this; it can be hard to keep track of. But at the same time, it's just cool. Even with when I feel like skipping stones, like that's how I look at it sometimes for myself. Is I'm just, I like take a step into it. I get to see all this depth that's being created for everybody. And it's cool because everybody has their own story. I don't think that you just go in there and you're just firing off into the void, because I do feel people are reacting to each other. They're engaging with one another. And just recently, I want to say just as of like yesterday, the warlords that are highlighted in the campaign package, I mentioned before, there's the orc, the kind of the weird boy mech boy mix. He's shown up in the Interlopers, the Xenos faction, engaging with folks. The Chaos Warlord, the Word Bearer, has started engaging with the Chaos team, and then the Rogue Trader has started engaging with the Imperium team. And so, like, you know, it's a player, a person role-playing that you can actively talk to. And that's been really cool to see. I mean, not just, I've got my own battle group, and we, like, talked a little bit and said, like, oh, hey, like, we noted that the Lord Rogue Trader has made their presence known throughout the system, and we're ready to serve or whatever. And then the Rogue Trader actually came into, like, our specific battle group channel and, like, was talking to the team and everything, which was really cool as we're kind of ramping up and getting started. It was very cool.
And this is all leading up. This is all the preamble to the
That's right.
Getting
it's just
to...
the preamble, just getting into it. So really exciting.
Oh, and that's all going to come to a head and, you know, play out over the course of the next weekend. So keep your eyes peeled to the Wareham community page, see what develops from that. Maybe tune into the stream, see if we can, you know, you might get some knowledge there. You know, really looking forward to what happens next week. So if you don't hear this show, please tune into that show and maybe keep an idea of what's going on. We're going to go and wrap us up for this week. Y'all got anything to throw in here before we wrap this up?
No, I mean, I'm excited for all the stuff that I'm going to hear about the grand narrative, because I'm going to be running a narrative league in the new year. So I'm going to really look forward to hearing what worked and what didn't. And I'm going to be watching the stream as well for ideas.
We'll see y'all, everybody.
Yep. See ya.
Prospect scan is clear. I think they're gone, for now.